Years earlier, from the events that are recorded in this 41st chapter of Genesis, Joseph's brothers had scornfully labelled him a dreamer. But it was Joseph's reputation as an interpreter of dreams that would lead to a transformation in his own circumstances and the salvation of his own brothers. That reputation, however, is but a tool used by God. It isn't central to the story of Joseph. In fact, what is central to the story of Joseph is Joseph's character. That is of far greater importance than this gift that God had given to him of interpretation of dreams. And there's a couple of things that I want to highlight briefly from this chapter this evening. Shouldn't take us very much time at all. And the first thing that I want to highlight is this. Joseph served God. Joseph served God. Simple as that. In fact, it's not just this chapter, but it's this chapter in the context of the chapters that have gone before that emphasize this point. Joseph served God. Joseph served God in the house of Potiphar. He was a slave. He was under forced employment in the house of the captain of the guard of Pharaoh. He had no choice, you may say. He served Potiphar. But no, he served God. It is made abundantly clear that he had served God, because though he acknowledges that Potiphar had handed over the control of the household to Joseph, even as a slave, because of the way God was prospering Joseph's work, and Potiphar noticed that, recognized that, and decided to profit from that. When it came to the crunch, Joseph acknowledged that it was God he was serving. When Potiphar's wife tried to tempt him into lying with her, Joseph acknowledged all that Potiphar had done, but concluded by saying, "How can I sin against God?" Demonstrating that ultimately, while he did these things for Potiphar, he was doing them with a view to serving God. Indeed, though he lived so many centuries earlier, Joseph was living out the exhortation of the Apostle Paul in Ephesians chapter 6. Slaves, obey your earthly masters with fear and trembling, with a sincere heart, as you would Christ. Not by the way of eye service as people pleasers, but as servants of Christ, doing the will of God from the heart, rendering service with a good will as to the Lord and not to man, knowing that whatever good anyone does, this he will receive back from the Lord, whether he is a slave or free. Indeed, Joseph not only served God in the house of Potiphar, but he served God in the prison too. It was a characteristic of his life. He didn't lounge around in idleness during his incarceration. He didn't dwell on his circumstances and go into a state of despair and despondency and discouragement. He got on with life within the limited circumstances that he was in, such that he was noticed. And he was given responsibility. And he was trusted. Because Joseph served God. Even there, in that prison, he served God. Whether prisoner, whether slave, Joseph served God, but he also served God when he was free. When he was exalted to the position of prime minister in the land of Egypt, Joseph served God. His service of God kept him from pride in that exalted position. As soon as he was commissioned by Pharaoh to take responsibility during the years of abundance, we read immediately Joseph went out over the land of Egypt. It is repeated for emphasis that Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went through all the land of Egypt. Immediately he sets himself to work, to labor. And he's characterized by prosperity. The same kind of prosperity that he had experienced in Potiphar's house and in the prison. And so we see that whatever his circumstances, Joseph served God. He had at the forefront of his mind his duty towards God. Regardless of who it was that was his immediate superior, whether it be a slave master, a prison guard, or the head of a superpower, Joseph always served God. And so should we. In whatever circumstances we find ourselves in, if we are Christians here this evening, it is our duty to do all things as unto the Lord. Regardless of who sees us, whether we're tucked away in obscurity or whether we're set in a place of prominence where the eyes of the nation observe what we do, whether we're in a menial position or one of great responsibility, we are to serve God. Now, the second thing that I want to state briefly is tied to that service of God. Joseph served God, and Joseph acknowledged God. Joseph acknowledged God. I suppose it would be possible for Joseph to have served God without ever mentioning God. I suppose it would be possible for him to have served in Potiphar's house and done a good job doing all things for God without ever mentioning God. And I suppose it would have been true in the prison, and I suppose it would also have been true in the palace of Pharaoh. But that's not the way Joseph operated. Joseph acknowledged God. He didn't hide his loyalty to God. Now, as with us, so for him, an acknowledgement of God would not have guaranteed respect, particularly under his circumstances, in a foreign country where numerous other gods were worshipped and where the Pharaoh himself was considered a kind of a god. But Joseph doesn't hide his loyalty to God. He acknowledges that it is God who gives wisdom and understanding. In fact, his own response to Pharaoh is marked by an emphasis. It's an emphatic response. Pharaoh says to Joseph in verse 15, "I have had a dream, and there is no one who can interpret it. I have heard it said of you that when you hear a dream, you can interpret it." This is what he's heard from the cupbearer. And Joseph answers, and the response is absolutely emphatic. He doesn't take time to think of a way that he can express himself in more respectful words. It's not in me. Don't label me as being an interpreter of dreams. God will give Pharaoh an answer. The ESV, along with a number of other translations, says God will give Pharaoh a favourable answer, though that probably isn't exactly what Joseph said, given that he hasn't yet heard the dream and has no idea what the content of the dream was and whether it would be a favourable answer or otherwise. In fact, in many ways, we could say that the dreams are not favourable. They become a happy ending because of Joseph's response. But it is God who is going to give an answer, not Joseph. He doesn't have the power. He doesn't take the credit for himself. He acknowledges that it is God who will tell Pharaoh. Furthermore, in all of this narrative, Joseph repeats emphatically that it is God who is in control. It is God who has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. It is as I told Pharaoh, God has shown to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Repeated again. God is in control. Pharaoh is no god. He is not in control. Ra or any of the other gods of Egypt, even the god of the Nile who was seen to bring prosperity or famine, he is not in control. It is the God of Joseph who is in control. And this God of Joseph has revealed to Pharaoh what he is about to do. Joseph acknowledges God. Jesus spoke of this acknowledgement regardless of circumstances, regardless of what we think may be the outcome. Jesus refers to it in Matthew's Gospel in chapter 10, where Jesus says, "Do not fear those who kill the body, but cannot kill the soul. Rather fear him who can destroy both soul and body in hell. Are not two sparrows sold for a penny, and not one of them will fall to the ground apart from your Father? But even the hairs of your head are all numbered. Fear not, therefore. You are of more value than many sparrows. So everyone who acknowledges me before men, I also will acknowledge before my Father who is in heaven. But whoever denies me before men, I also will deny before my Father who is in heaven." Joseph acknowledged God. He had no idea what Pharaoh's response would be to that acknowledgement. He didn't know whether Pharaoh would be favorable in his response, or whether Pharaoh would take offense at Joseph's assertion that his God was in control and that the gods of Egypt were impotent in comparison. Yet he acknowledges God. God gives wisdom and understanding. God interprets dreams. God is in control. And then he proceeds to interpret these two dreams that Pharaoh has dreamt. Pharaoh himself seems to have recognized a connection between the two. When they're first described for us at the beginning of the chapter, they're described as two distinct dreams. He woke up after the first dream, and then he fell asleep again, and he dreamed a second dream. When Pharaoh recounts the dreams, He tells the first dream and says that he woke up, and then he adds, "Oh, I also saw in my dream." And so it's one dream. And Joseph confirms what Pharaoh had guessed, that yes, this is one dream, with two pictures to confirm to Pharaoh that God has determined that these events will unfold as he has predicted. There is no negotiation here. God has determined, he has fixed, that these things will shortly come about. And it's no good for Pharaoh to plead that there might be a different outcome. God is telling Pharaoh that these things will happen. And it's interesting, isn't it, that Joseph goes beyond simply interpreting the dream. He offers Pharaoh some advice. He helps Pharaoh to see that while this thing is fixed, it's not fatalism. In other words, everything will depend upon what Pharaoh does next. There will be years of abundance, years of plenty, and there will be years of famine. What Pharaoh does in those years will determine the outcome of this story. Will it have a happy ending or a disastrous ending? This dream then calls forth from Pharaoh a response. And Joseph makes that clear by going on to say, "Let Pharaoh appoint overseers. Let Pharaoh select a discerning, wise man to oversee Egypt. Let Pharaoh store up during the years of plenty so that there may be provision for the years of famine." And in all of this, Pharaoh himself is brought to acknowledge Joseph's God. He says to his servants, "Can we find a man like this in whom is the Spirit of God?" And Pharaoh said to Joseph, "Since God has shown you all this, there is none so discerning and wise as you are. You shall be over my house. You shall be to me as you were to Potiphar." Pharaoh doesn't say that, but he uses the same words, you see. And so, even though we may not know the rest of the outcome of this story, we can predict it. If this was the very first time that we were reading through this, we have observed Joseph serves God. Joseph acknowledges God. God prospers Joseph. He did it in Potiphar's house. He did it in the prison. He will do it in the whole land of Egypt. And in doing so, he will bring glory and honor to his own name. And so the story unfolds as we might expect. The 7 years of abundance come, and Joseph operates a wise organization of gathering, collecting, and storing in each region, in each city, as the crops are brought in. So a portion is set aside, stored, and guarded until the time when it is needed. And even when it's needed, he doesn't immediately open up the doors of those storehouses. He waits until the famine has become severe, until the people are crying out. And then he opens the storehouses, and then he sells to the Egyptians. The idea is here of rationing, of measuring out in portions to give to the people of Egypt as they come famished to the storehouses in the cities in their regions. Now, before the famine strikes, and in the midst of the years of abundance, Joseph has two sons born to him. And it's interesting to note the names that he gives to them. Because again, in this is an acknowledgement of God. The first thing that we can note, which isn't directly obvious, so let me state it for you, Joseph gives them Hebrew names, not Egyptian names. He knows that he's not an Egyptian, though many of the foreigners coming into Egypt at this time don't see any difference in him, as we will discover later when his brothers come to Egypt. But his sons' names are Hebrew names. He knows his heritage. He knows where he belongs, even though he's in this foreign land. He knows this is not his home. And the names that he gives to his sons, Manasseh, it sounds like the Hebrew word forget. And he explains why he's given Manasseh his name. God has made me forget all my hardship and all my father's house. Now that doesn't mean that he's forgotten who his father is and he's forgotten his brothers and he's ignoring their existence. Rather, it has the sense of he has made me to forget the hardship in my father's house, the tension that there was there, the hatred, the obvious, palpable hatred of his brothers towards him. It's all gone. It's all history. It's all in the past. God has made me forget. And Ephraim means God made me fruitful. God has turned Joseph's circumstances around. Troubles have been banished, and fruitfulness is promised. This is true of all who are faithful to God. Troubles are banished. Fruitfulness is promised. Now, that doesn't mean that the trouble ceases to exist. It means that trouble doesn't become a dominant factor in our lives. We see beyond the trouble and recognize that God puts us in the place he puts us to be fruitful for him. This was the testimony of the Apostle Paul. In his letter to the church in Philippi, he says in chapter 1, writing from prison, I will rejoice, for I know that through your prayers and the help of the Spirit of Jesus Christ, this will turn out for my deliverance, as it is my eager expectation and hope that I will not be at all ashamed, but that will, with full courage, now as always, Christ will be honored in my body, whether by life or by death. For to me, to live is Christ, and to die is gain. That, I think, would have been Joseph's motto, though he wouldn't have used the word Christ, but God. If I am to live in the flesh, that means fruitful labor for me. Yet which I shall choose, I cannot tell. I am hard pressed between the two. My desire is to depart and be with Christ, for that is far better. But to remain in the flesh is more necessary on your account. God can enable us to forget our troubles even in the midst of them. Joseph doesn't dwell on his troubles even when he is a slave in Potiphar's house, even when he is imprisoned in Pharaoh's prison. He serves God. He acknowledges God. And he is blessed by fruitfulness by God. And Christ must be everything to us if we are his followers. Christ must be our motivation in service. I do it for him. However oppressive my circumstances may be, however unsympathizing my boss may be, I will serve for Christ. I will do it as to him. Christ will be our motivation in service. Christ will be our testimony in life. We will acknowledge him. We will take every opportunity to acknowledge God in our lives and the work of Christ in our lives. His name will trip off our tongue in everyday conversation because it is so natural to us to be thinking of him and serving him and acknowledging him. And then Christ will be our hope of glory. He is the one that gives us assurance that our present circumstances are not to be compared to the glory that will be ours when we conquer temptation, sin, and circumstances to serve Christ and acknowledge him and to be fruitful for him. Joseph's example is our calling. Let us serve God. Let us acknowledge God. Let us be fruitful for him, not for ourselves.